Okay, well, Purim is finally over in all locations, with the possible exception of one or two shtibles that are nearby. And we resume our deliberations in the weekly parsha, and we have this week, as we come to Parshas Vayakel. And let us see what the Parsha has to say to us. Of course, in the main, we look at Parshas Vayakel as the other side of Parshas Truma, in the sense that Parshas Truma are the commands with respect to the building of the Mishkan, and then Parshas Vayakel is the execution thereof. And therefore, we might be inclined to see it as something of a quote-unquote, not repetition, but a reiteration of the making of the Mishkan. But as we have always discover, there is a great deal of further insight and distinct insight that Parshas Vayakel has to offer us. And we begin at the beginning, in the sense that for all that we've just said, that Parshas Vayakel is about the building of the Mishkan, as we know, it actually starts with Shabbos. And that's Vayakel Moshe, Eskol Adas B'nei Yisrael, Vayomer Alehem. Moshe gathers, assembles the Jewish people, and says to them, Eile HaDvarim Asher Tziva Hashem Lasos Osam. And we're ready for the Mishkan, but there are two psukim beforehand that deal with Shabbos. Sheshes yomim te'asim melacha, for 6 days melacha shall be done. Ubayom ha'shvi'i yelechem kodesh, on the seventh day shall be kodesh for you. Shabbos, Shabbos on Hashem, a holy Shabbos for Hashem. That's interesting that Shabbos is called Shabbos Shabboson. We normally think of Shabbos as Shabbos, and Yom Kippur is called Shabbos Shabboson. But Shabbos itself is Shabbos Shabboson, as the Mefarshim discuss. Kol oseh bo melacha yumas, and the penalty for doing melacha Shabbos is the most severe. And then one melacha is singled out. Lo sevaru eish b'chol mashvaseichem b'yom haShabbos, not to kindle a fire on Shabbos. What is Shabbos doing before the main topic, so to speak, of the Mishkan? Well, Rashi informs us that it really is apropos of the Mishkan, in the sense that although the Jewish people are about to be told to build the Mishkan, they are first informed that Shabbos takes precedence, meaning the building of the Mishkan does not override Shabbos. And therefore, the moral of the story is Shabbos comes first. Although this has already been told, according to Rashi, to Moshe in last week's Parsha, in Kisisa, where there was a discussion of the Mishkan, and then Achas Shabsosai Tishmoru, Rashi says, but the Mishkan doesn't override Shabbos. Why would that need to be said again? And in, additionally, in last week's Parsha, the Mishkan was mentioned before Shabbos. First Mishkan, and then Shabbos, as if to say, the Mishkan stops on Shabbos. The building of the Mishkan stops on Shabbos. Here, the very same message is communicated with the reverse order. Shabbos first and then Mishkan, but the message is the same. Shabbos comes first. So whatever the order will be, the message emerges as the same. But as we know, halachically, the connection between Shabbos and the Mishkan goes deeper than that. It's not merely that you don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Rather, as we know, the identification of the malachas that are asur to do on Shabbos are actually drawn from the malachas that were done in the Mishkan. The juxtaposition of Shabbos and Mishkan tells us that although the Torah has stated very generally not to do malacha, which malachas specifically? We have the famous 39 malachas, lametes malachos, and they are actually learnt from the Mishkan. And this leads us to a simple question. Ma inyan Mishkan Eitzel Shabbos? in the sense that of the malachus, we assume that if we're meant to rest from malacha on Shabbos, we're resting from the malachus that were involved in the creation of the world, however we're able to fathom them and find them out. But now we discover that the malachus that we need to desist from are the malachus that were involved in the Mishkan. How does resting from the Mishkan malachas allow us to fulfill the idea of resting from malachas with which the world was created? And there is an idea that many Mefarshim say it has its roots in Rabbeinu Bachya and it's developed by others, that this really takes us closer to the connection between the world and the Mishkan itself. It's very illuminating to refer even briefly to a fascinating passage of the Medrash Tanchuma. It's in Parshas Pekudei. And basically, the Medrash identifies many parallels between the component parts or the functions that were described with the creation of the world and those that are found in the Mishkan, both the function and the process. This is in Medrash Tanchuma Parshas Pekudei Siman Beis. It says, for example, how does creation begin? Bereishis bara Elokim, Esa Shamayim ve'Esa Aretz. So the heavens were created. Tehillim tells us in Barchi Nafshi, Nota Shamayim Kayiria, that Hashem stretched out the heavens, Kayiria, like a curtain. What is on top of the Mishkan? Yirios. Yirios of Tcheles, Yirios of Izim, that corresponds to the heavens. The concept of dividing different things also features in both. The Rakia was there in order to divide, Vihi Mavdil, Bein Mayim, Lamayim, to divide between the higher waters, the lower waters, however one defines those things. And likewise, you have the Paroches, V'hivdila ha-paroches lachem, also comes to divide. On the third day, Hashem said, Yikavu ha-mayim, let the waters collect into one place, namely into the sea. And also in the Mishkan, we have the kior, which is a collection of water. On the fourth day, Yehi ma'oros, luminaries were made. And so too, we have the menorah in the Mishkan, and so on and so forth. Everything that's created in the world has a counterpart in the Mishkan. And moreover, as we said, the process as well, because if we look in next week's Parsha, once the Mishkan has been made, so when the heavens were created, it says, Vayichulu Hashemayim V'Haaretz. Vayichulu, it was completed, as we say in Kiddush on Friday night. And with regards to the Mishkan, Vayichal, Biyom Kalos Moshe, also came to a conclusion. What does Hashem do to Shabbos? Vayivorech Elokim Es Yom HaShvi'i, Hashem blesses the Shabbos, which is the culmination of creation. Vayikadish Oso, and sanctifies it. And so too, Moshe sanctifies the Mishkan, Vayimshach Oso, Vayikadish Oso, and he blesses the Bnei Yisrael, Vayivorech Osam Moshe. So the Kiddush and the Bracha also of the world and of the Mishkan parallel each other. And what are all of these parallels drawing us towards? That the connection between the Mishkan on the one hand and Shamayim V'aretz, the creation itself on the other, is that the Mishkan is a microcosm, a miniature representation. All of the elements of the Bria of the world are to be found in the Mishkan. It is a world in miniature. And indeed, Reb Chaim V'lozhin, in the Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, discusses this matter, because he refers us to a Gemara in Maseches Brachos with regards to Bezalel. The Brachos Daf Nun Hei Amad Aleph talks about Bezalel and has a most remarkable comment. It says, Yodea haya Bezalel, Bezalel knew Litzarif Osios, how to combine the letters of the Aleph base, right? The letters, they are the almost like the spiritual building blocks. Shebahem Nivra Shemaim V'aretz, with which the world was created. Says Reb Chaim Volozhin, I think if you want someone to build the Mishkan, it's good to have someone who's qualified. This sounds a little overqualified. I mean, it's a Mishkan. It's a building. No one's asking him to create the world. That's already happened. Why does he need to have that knowledge? As Bezalel is called, Hashem says, I filled him with Bechochma, Bebina, Uvedas. And so too, when Hashem is described as creating the world, Hashem, Yasad Bechochma Eretz, Konen Shemayim Bitvuna, Bidat Totahomas Digba'u, Hashem creates the world with Chochma, Bina, and Das, Bezalel is Chochma, Bina, and Das. He has the knowledge of how the world was created. Why does he need that? Says Reb Chaim Volozhin, because that's what he's doing. Not the original, not in macro, but in micro. And therefore, he will need to use that knowledge as he's building the Mishkan, this miniature world, which really reflects and parallels the creation of the world itself. Achar hadvarim ha'ele. With this in mind, we can well understand why it would be that if we, in our human experience, wish to replicate Hashem's resting from the creation of the world, and we're looking for the malachas that reflect that, there is no better place to look than the Mishkan. Because as we've seen through these sources, through the Medrash, through the Nefesh HaChayim, the Mishkan really does represent the world, and therefore the malachas in its production will be our parallel to the malachas of the creation of the world itself. So that is a fascinating understanding of the cohesion and the synergy between the Mishkan and the world. And indeed, the Medrash says elsewhere that the world was not fully firmed until the Mishkan was created. It's almost like the final installment, the Makkeh B'Patish, if we can use a Malacha term for the creation. That's the approach of Rabbeinu Bachya. But there is a parallel approach, a complementary approach, I would say. And it comes from Rav Huttner. If we're looking to discuss the relationship between the Mishkan and the world, and so far we've said that what it means is that the Mishkan is a miniature representation of the world, and that's how they're connected, it's possible that the converse is also true. And this brings us to one of the primary ideas within Torah, and that is, where is religion found? And what is the role of the shul in that regard? As we know, there are many places or many creeds where they have their place of worship, and that's where their religion takes place. But they leave it behind. It doesn't go beyond the walls of their sanctuary. And outside of that, anything is possible, and never the twain shall meet. There is no notion of a pervasive religious experience or existence. But Torah is not like that. And indeed, lahavdil, you know, even within ourselves, when the strains that began to depart from Torah Judaism and were looking to redo religion, reform and such like, all of their innovations were in the shul, the synagogue, which really reflects an idea that that's really where religion is. When Rav Hirsch set up his Auschwitz community in Frankfurt, he made a point of not building the shul first. First was built a school, and then a mikveh, because this is life. And that's where religion is to be found. Of course, it's to be found in shul also, but it should emanate outwards from the shul. And indeed, Rav Kook has two very wonderful comments in this regard. The Gemara tells us in the fifth parak of Brachos, we know that one should ideally wait a little bit before davening, not just rush into davening. The famous Hasidim Harishonim, the early pious ones, they would wait a while, prepare themselves before davening. But the Gemara adds, not only would they wait before davening, spend some time in shul, they would also wait after davening. And of course, everyone wants to know, what's there to do after davening? In other words, to prepare is one thing, but now it's done. And still they would wait. And Rav Kook says, because there's still work to be done. What is the role of that hour or however long it is after davening? It's for them to ponder and reflect the ideas that I've connected with now in davening, in shul, how do I bring them into to my daily experience? How do I take them out of shul and put them into the world? It's worth a moment of reflection, perhaps more than a moment. And that's what that Shah Achas after davening was for. And for this very reason, and it's based on also on our parsha, the Gemara states that a shul should have windows. It seems like a very easy halacha to fulfill. Any building has windows. Although for many of the shuls, certainly here in Israel, if they start in someone's miklat, so then perhaps they're not able to. And maybe that's a gentle reminder that they that this is not their final destination of the shul. Many a congregation, as we've said, in Israel begins as an underground movement. And it's in the basement or the miklat. But once you're above ground, it's very natural for a place to have windows. But the halacha insists, and it's learned from the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash had windows, and it's of the essence. But why? Says Rav Kook, because without windows, there is no connection or cohesion between the inside of the shul and the outside of the shul. If you're in one, you can't see the other. Obviously, you're not meant to spend your davening looking out of the window. But there should be some point of connection, of visual connection, so that whatever happens in here should then carry through to out there. And that's how Rav Kook explains the idea of windows for prayer, of a shul having windows. And with this in mind, Achara Dvarma Eile, says the Pachad Yitzchak, maybe that is another message that runs through, another layer of understanding why it is that the halachas of Shabbos are learned from the Mishkan, which shows us that the world and the Mishkan are connected. The first approach that we took is that the Mishkan, it's a statement about the Mishkan, that it's a micro-representation of the world. But Pachad Yitzchak suggests that perhaps it's more a statement about the world, that it's an extension of the Mishkan, that it's an expansion of the concepts and values that pervade the Mishkan and make up the daily avodah. Those should then spill out into the world so that the two are one, and we even begin to learn the halachos of one from the other. So these are some classic comments with regards to the relationship between Malachos of Shabbos and the Mishkan. And as we like to do, me'inyan le'inyan, if we can take a look at a nugget of the mitzvahs of Shabbos, and as we always remind ourselves, this is not a halacha shir. There's plenty of poskim around to consult for the details and the practicalities, but nonetheless, to get a sense of some of the core ideas and dynamics and classic highlights. One of the melachos of Shabbos that we encounter on a weekly basis in our experience is the prohibition against cooking. And interestingly, although in our experience cooking takes place with food, the source for the melacha of cooking in the Mishkan was not food. They didn't cook food as part of the preparation for the building of the Mishkan. Rather, it was the cooking of the dyes, of those vegetable extracts and matters to be able to then use them to dye the various materials. That's where bishul is to be found. Now, as we know, cooking is not the only way to prepare food through heat. There's also baking, there's also roasting. Cooking is with water. Those two aren't, and each one is distinct from themselves. And of course, we know certainly if not avos, then toldos, that the prohibition against cooking applies equally to any of those preparations through heat. As surely as it is forbidden to cook through water, it is equally forbidden to bake, equally forbidden to roast. The question, the very interesting question, is as follows. There is a principle that once something is cooked, it can't be cooked again. If it's already been cooked, it's done. In the parlance of the halacha, ein bishul achar bishul. There is no cooking after cooking, meaning once it's cooked, it's cooked. So if you would cook it again, it doesn't mean anything in terms of the malacha. This is generally the practice for solid foods. For liquids, the practice is if it's cooled down, it's considered to have lost some of its cookness. So to reheat it would be a problem. But if we're talking about a solid piece of food, ein bishul achar bishul. And this leads us to a very interesting question. Once something's cooked, it can never be cooked again. But what if it's prepared by heat in a different way? And then you cook it. Does that make a difference? What if it was originally baked? If you cook it now, would that be a malacha? What if it was originally roasted? To cook it now, would that be a malacha? And vice versa. One could say, at the root of the question, is really, do we look upon all these things, as much as they have their differences, and one's baking, and one's cooking, and one's roasting, but they're all really variations on the same theme, which means that in the same way that once you've cooked, it can't be cooked again, so once it's prepared another way, it can't, because lamaisa, it's been prepared through heat, cooking won't really make a difference halachically, if it's already been baked or roasted, let's say. Or do we say no? Cooking and baking and roasting, they're not variations on a theme. They're distinct themes. And maybe it was baked, but it was never cooked. And if it's cooked on Shabbos, that's the malacha of Bishul. That is the question. And as we will see, this was the subject of a major dispute between two of the Rishonim, cited in the Beis Yosef. The Yoreim, Rabbi Eliezer of Metz. The Yoreim is of the opinion that there is the possibility of cooking after baking, meaning it would be forbidden. It's considered to be cooked. Even if it was baked already, to cook it then would be a full act of cooking. And he derives support for this from the Gemara. The Gemara in Maseches Psachim. Now, Maseches Psachim, the focus actually is on the Korban Pesach, which, as we know, has to be roasted. So the mitzvah is to roast the Korban Pesach. And moreover, there's a prohibition to cook it. Al tochlu mimenu na uvashel muvushal b'mayim. It cannot be cooked. Kiyam tzli'esh, it can only be roasted. So you've got to roast it, you can't cook it. And of course, the Gemara wants to know, what if someone did both? What if he first roasted it, so far so good, and then he took it and he cooked it? Is he in violation of the prohibition of cooking the Korban Pesach? He didn't cook it from scratch. It's already been roasted. We can hear that it's actually the same question, seemingly. Is it called cooking if it's already been prepared through heat in another way, through roasting? And the Gemara answers, he would be chayav. He would be liable for the prohibition against cooking. It doesn't matter that it's been roasted. Now he's cooked it. And indeed, the Gemara proves the point by referring to a statement of Rabbi Yossi about matzah. Matzah, as we know, has to be baked. And Rabbi Yossi says, if you baked matzah and then you cooked it, leaving aside all gebrocht issues, if you baked matzah and then you cooked it, you no longer fulfill the mitzvah of matzah because it's not baked anymore. It's become cooked. It was baked, but then you cooked it. And now everything is different. So from these two sources, these two applications, says the Yoreim, we see that the fact that something was prepared by heat in one way doesn't preclude the notion that it can still be then susceptible to being fully considered prepared by heat in a different way. There is the concept of bishul exists after baking or or roasting. And that is the approach of the Yoreim, which means that if something had been baked on Shabbos, you would not be allowed to cook it. It would be a full Isser Torah. Practical applications we'll get to in just a moment. But not before we hear from another of the Rishonim who takes issue with the Yoreim. And that is the Ravya. The Ravya, again, one of the great Ashkenazi Rishonim. And the Ravya is of the opinion that once you've prepared it through heat in one way, it's done. There's nothing else you can do to it that will make a difference as far as Shabbos is concerned. Just like if you cooked it already, there's no meaning of cooking it again. If you baked it, cooking won't make a difference, and so on. And he proves it from the fact that elsewhere, this is in Maseches Brachos and Lamed Ches, and the Ravyo seems to take this as the primary halachic position. It also cites Rabbi Yossi, who says that if you cooked matzah, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah. But the Gemara adds words of explanation. Because the taste is not the same anymore. It's got to taste like matzah. That's a problem. There's no doubting that once you cook matzah, it doesn't taste like matzah anymore. But says the Rav, when you think about it, no one is saying that it's now considered cooked and not baked. It's just you shouldn't interfere with the taste of the matzah. That sounds like a very local issue with matzah, but it doesn't sound like there's actual halachic import to the cooking after the baking. And interestingly, the Beis Yosef, who's hosting this entire discussion, he notes this question of the Ravya and says, "Vezu kushya chazaka." This is a very difficult question on the position of the Urim. And that's important because when the Shulchan Aruch codifies this matter, he brings both opinions. He says, there is an opinion that it's a problem to cook after baking, but there are those who say that there is no problem. And many Mefarshim understand that Rabbi Yosef Karo is really identifying with the second position because he so endorsed and praised the kasha of the Ravya, and that therefore what it would seem to be the position of the Shulchan Aruch, and this is adopted by many Sephardi communities, that they're not concerned. Once it's already been prepared through heat in one way, it can be prepared through heat in another way, even on Shabbos. The Ramah, however, representing Ashkenazi practice, he takes up the position of the Urim, where we started, and he says, no, even if it's been baked, you can't cook it, and vice versa, and so on. Even in a Kli Sheni, as we know, the original, where the water is the Kli Rishon. If you would pour that to another vessel, it's a Kli Sheni. Only in a Kli Shlishi is there room to be lenient. Thus far, theory. But now, in case we're hungry, we need to know what are the practical applications of this matter. And two classic examples, which will really be very, very common experience, and that's why it's so valuable to know the background to these discussions in the Rishonim. Challah in chicken soup. Classic Jewish delicacy. Now, assuming that the chicken soup is hot, because if it's just warm, and different people have their different customs as to how hot their chicken soup. If it's just warm, so then it's not an issue anyway. But if it has that critical heat level, which is called the temperature of Yad Soledespo, so now we're talking, would it be acceptable to put challah into soup? This seemingly would be a testing ground between the two approaches, because the challah has been baked, but it's never been cooked. And therefore, according to the Shulchan Aruch, who sides with the idea that once it's been baked, nothing else can happen to it, there would be no problem whatsoever to put the challah in the soup. But for Ashkenazim, seemingly, there would be a problem, because Ashkenazim are stringent, like the Urim. It's been baked, but it's never been cooked. Interestingly, on a practical level, it could be that Ashkenazim can also be lenient here, because the saving grace here is the ladle. The pot of soup where it was cooked is the Kli Rishon. When you put the ladle inside, so that's already another Kli. So when you put it into your bowl, that's a Kli Shlishi. And as we've seen, even the opinion of the Ramah, who's stringent, but he's lenient with regards to a Kli Shlishi, so it would seem that all could be lenient in this matter, even Ashkenazim, because by the time it gets to your bowl, it is a Kli Shlishi. It is cautioned, though, that the ladle shouldn't stay inside the soup for so long that it basically becomes nullified practically and loses its status as a distinct Kli. But that's the issue with the challah in the soup. With regards to croutons, presumably it would be the same if they've been baked. And people who are particular about these things, they prefer croutons that have only been baked. It's exactly like challah. Once again, presumably in a Kli Shlishi, it's fine. The situation is even easier if they're soup nuts, because soup nuts have often been deep fried. And although deep fried doesn't sound the same as cooking, it is exactly the same as cooking, because the only difference is, has it been immersed in water or immersed in oil? which might put some people off their croutons, but that's what it is. And therefore, the preparation of croutons is actually looked upon as cooking, an ein bishul achar bishul. The final example for us this evening would be coffee. Instant coffee, for those who drink it, often has actually already been cooked. In other words, what comes in the jar is really the dried results of something that's gone through a cooking process, in which case, if it's been cooked, hot water won't cook it anymore, and that should be acceptable. But there are some types of coffee, certainly here in Israel, what's called Turkish coffee. Turkish coffee has never been cooked, but it has been roasted. And we're back again to our question now. Would it be acceptable to pour hot water on something that's been roasted, even though it hasn't been cooked? And this is discussed by Rav Avadya Yosef in the Chavedas. And as per our above discussion, he is of the opinion that for a Sfaradim it's acceptable because, again, ein bishul after anything. Once it's been prepared through heat, through roasting, it doesn't matter. Whereas for Ashkenazim, they'd probably want to wait for a kli shlishi. So these are some practical examples. And again, just checking in with the whole world of Hilchos Shabbos, as the Gemara describes it, hararim hatzuluyim besara, like mountains suspended by threads. The Torah tells us very little details about the malachos of Shabbos. They're learned from the juxtaposition to the Mishkan. And even the malachos that are in the Mishkan are not all spelled out. These are things that we have through our traditions, and therefore the Pasuk says, don't do any malacha, and the result of that is the whole corpus, which is called Hilchos Shabbos. It's very interesting, just to bring this discussion back to where we started, that the one malacha that was mentioned is kindling a fire. And the Gemara, of course, discusses this in more than one place as to why the malacha of kindling would be separated for separate mention. But as per our discussion, there are those who suggest, I believe the Torah Tumima says, that fire as we have it is actually, we have a tradition, this was given to Adam HaRishon on Motzei Shabbos. Because he spent Shabbos in the darkness. He didn't know what was happening. He didn't realize that this was the first time night had ever existed in human experience. And he thought the world was coming to an end. But then when the morning came, he saw that the sun came out again. But by the next evening, it's already Motzei Shabbos. And Hashem told him how to kindle fire. So if we say that the malachos on Shabbos correspond to the malachos of the creation of the world, but the creation of fire was given to Adam on Motzei Shabbos, that would explain why it has to be mentioned separately as a malacha and cannot be derived from any of the other malachas with regards to the creation of the world. Of course, Hashem made the sun and the stars. They are fire of sorts, but in terms of kindling a fire, as in our experience, that was a Motzei Shabbos introduction and therefore warrants a separate mention. So moving on from Shabbos to the Mishkan itself, so much of the opening part of the parsha deals with the contributions for the Mishkan. And as the psukim described, the contributions came in with much fervor, with much enthusiasm, with much excitement. In fact, there's a very interesting comment of the Rachaim HaKadosh in Pasuk Kaf at the beginning of our parsha. It's the last Pasuk of Rishon. And Moshe is basically saying all of the things that need, all the materials that need to be collected. And then he finishes. He finishes his list in Pasuk Yotes. And Pasuk Kaf says, Vayetzu'u kol adas b'nei Yisrael milifnei Moshe. The entire congregation went out from before Moshe. And it's a pasuk that's so easy to read. But when you think about it, what is it telling us? In other words, he congregated them. He gave them a message. Presumably, when he finishes, people will leave because they need to go and start to implement it. Why is the Pasuk specifically telling us that the people left? And the Rachaim HaKadosh says, here, the Pasuk is communicating to us the enthusiasm of the people. You know, normally, apart from anything else, if Moshe Rabbeinu comes in to give a shiur or to give a message and he's finished, so it's in a sense Derech Eretz that he should leave, and then people can make their way out. They left before Moshe. No sooner had he finished speaking, they didn't even wait for him to leave. They were already out the door, on their way to collect their materials for the Mishkan. And that already shows the atmosphere of the donations for the Mishkan. And as the Psukim continue to describe, this is in Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Hey. Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Hey. People are donating and donating. Vayomu el Moshe Lemor. People came and said to Moshe, Marbim ha'am la'avi. They're just bringing in abundance. Midei ha'avodah l'mlacha, asher tzivah she'naso sasa. It's already almost like too much. So much so, and I wonder if in the history of receiving contributions, how many times this was repeated, they sent a message out for people to stop contributing. It's, we have enough. Pasuk vav, vayitzav Moshe, vayaviru kol b'machane, le'mor, they sent out a message in the camp, ish v'isha, ayasu od melocha l'trumas ha'kodesh. No more. And people stopped. But vayikalei ha'am me'avi, it sounds like they had to be stopped. Like vayichulu, and as the pasuk pasuk Zion concludes, v'amalacha haisadayim, it was enough. L'chol hamalacha lasososa v'hoser, and it was more than enough. It was enough and more. This was the situation of these donations, and as the Mefarshim point out, it's important to take note of this atmosphere. Because the Mishkan is coming, as we know, as a tikkun, as a rectification for the Chet HaEgel. And the full rectification, if one is looking to rectify evil by doing good, so one has to match the level with which the evil was done. And let's consider for a moment the atmosphere of the Chet HaEgel. There is a classic comment of the Sforno, relating to last week's parsha, with regards to Moshe breaking the luchos. As we know, he takes the luchos, and when he sees the people are worshipping the eagle, he breaks the luchos. And the Sforno asks a simple question. If you're breaking the luchos because you feel that the Jewish people don't deserve them, but you've already been told that the people made the eagle by Hashem himself, which means if in your conception they do not deserve to have the luchos, so leave them with Hashem. Why do you have to take them and break them? What was the goal of taking them? Were you planning on breaking them all along? So maybe Hashem doesn't want you to break them. Just leave them with him if the Jewish people don't deserve them. And that is why the Sforno says no. In truth, Moshe was not originally planning on breaking the luchos. Moshe was originally planning on drawing the Jewish people out from their sin through the luchos. In Moshe's understanding, yes, he's been told they made an egel. It's a terrible thing. They've made a mistake. But people can recover from their mistakes. Moshe went missing. Clearly, there was a misunderstanding. The people got impatient and they took a wrong turn. But they can be brought back. And what better way to bring them back than by showing them the luchos? Reminding them, this is what you should be doing. This is your direction. This is your focus. And thus, Moshe took the luchos, showed them the luchos, and everything will be fine. But then something happened. The pasuk says, as Moshe approached the camp, Vayar es ha'egel u'mecholos. He saw the egel and mecholos. What is machol? Machol is a circle. It's a dancing circle. Moshe had been told that the people had made the egel. If you made an egel, it's a terrible thing. But you can recover, and maybe just the sight of the luchos are enough. But if you made an egel and you start dancing around it, When people start dancing around their mistakes, seeing the luchos is not gonna do it. They're happy. They're happy with what they're doing. So why shift? And interestingly, as my uncle Rav Kuperman Zatzal pointed out, you see in the pasuk again the words that we cited, Vayar es ha'egel umecholos. The word egel is prefaced with the letter hey, ha'egel. The word mecholos is not prefaced with the letter hey. It doesn't say Vayar es ha'egel ve'hamecholos or ve'es ha'mecholos. And the reason why is really as per what the Sforno is saying. Because the letter hey represents the hey ha'yadiyah, the definite article, the known entity. It says ha'egel because Moshe knew about the egel. He'd been informed about the egel. But in the interim, they're already dancing. No one had informed him about the dancing. It's not ha'mecholos. It wasn't known to him. It became known now. The Sforno cites the pasuk, ki ra'asechi az ta'alozi. Not only are you doing the wrong thing, you're happy with it. Ki ra'asechi, from the word ra'a, you have your evil, az ta'alozi, but at the same time, you're happy. Aliz. At this point, Moshe still has the luchos, but the sight of the luchos is not going to be enough. If people are dancing around the egel, it's going to need more than that. And Moshe smashes the luchos in front of them. They need to be broken out of it. They need to be traumatized, because otherwise everything is fine. Often consider, I may have mentioned when we discussed this Sforno, the amazing notion, if indeed they were dancing in a circle, then a good amount of those who were involved, they didn't even see Moshe. They had their backs to him. The first notion they had that he'd return would be the sound of smashing luchos. And they would turn around. What just happened? People weren't even looking at Moshe, half of them. And even those that were, but they're focused on the egel. That is the atmosphere of the Chet HaEgel. But then when we're looking to recover from that, it begins with the breaking of the luchos. But where does it end? If the root of the problem is not just doing the wrong thing, but a celebration of the wrong thing, then the full rectification cannot just be doing the right thing. It has to be a celebration of the right thing. If the problem is one of celebration, the answer cannot be just one of declaration. It's got to be a counter-celebration. And that's why so much emphasis is laid on the enthusiasm with which people, they're happy, they're waiting. Moshe barely has finished his final sentence and people are already out the door. They can't wait. And this is part of it. And that's how it should be. And this is the full tikkun for the egel. And that remains true. That remains true. The full rectification of evil is not just to do good things, it's to be happy with the right thing. That's a full reclaiming. And the truth is, this is something, again, we're just pulling out of Purim, each one in a different time. But Purim is also a time of celebration. And it's of the essence. Because famously, the Jewish people are faulted. As the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah, Shenenu misudoso shel Achashverosh. They enjoyed the Sud of Achashverosh. And many Meforshim say, there's room to debate, or at least mitigate on their behalf. It's not an easy thing to avoid the Sud of Achashverosh. He's the king. Everyone needs to be there. It's not right. But maybe you also need to be there. Maybe in that regard, it was difficult for them. But Nehenu Misudasa Shel Achashverosh. To enjoy at that party. And what does that party represent? That party represents effectively the demise of the Jewish people as a significant entity. The time has come. They haven't been called back as far as Achashverosh is concerned. Now it's Persia is in charge. To be part of that and to join in that celebration, it's almost like a redo of the Chet HaEgel in that respect. And that's why there's so much contained within the joy of Purim. The joy of Purim is not just a retraction, originally we celebrated what seemed to be the end of the Jewish people. We're no longer the Jewish people, and now we can just naturalize as Persian citizens, which was not the last time that the Jewish people would try to do that. But if that's a problem, then it will only fully be rectified by a celebration of being Jewish. And that is what Purim is all about. It's a celebration of Netzach Yisrael. And this then ties in very much to our discussion of the Mishkan as well. And it's a concept that remains true for all other such situations. With regards to the generosity of spirit, which so pervaded, it's interesting to consider that there may have been people who wanted to contribute to the Mishkan and were not able to. As we read, they were told to stop bringing donations. So if you hadn't donated, and it took place over 2 days, baboke, if it took place and if you hadn't got your donation in, you may have wanted to, but it's too late. And that's that, seemingly. There were people who donated actually, and there were people that just were not able to. Whatever became of them, or whatever became of their will, says Rav Meir Shapira, we have a principle that if a person really genuinely wants to do an Aveira, wants to do a mitzvah, and he's prevented from doing so, it's counted as a mitzvah. Choshav adam lasos mitzvah venenas velo asa mala olav akosav kilo asa. It's considered as if he did a mitzvah. If he was just prevented from doing so, but he wanted to. And that seems to be where the matter rests. However, says Rav Meir Shapira, in this instance, their desire to contribute actually made a difference. The Gemara discusses in a few places, in Masechet Zvachim and in Masechet Shavuos, we know that the Mishkan, the premises of the Beis HaMikdash and of the Mishkan, are sanctified. But the Gemara goes one stage further and says that also the airspace of the Mishkan was also sanctified. That's very interesting, because it's contained within the enclosure, but we're talking about an object that, let's say, has not come to rest on the floor. Maybe the floor has been sanctified. The floor is an object. If it touches one of the walls are sanctified. The walls are an object. But air is just air. How do you sanctify it? And Rav Meir Shapira said, the way you sanctify ruach is with ruchnius. It's with spirit. Where does that spirit come from? The generosity of spirit of the Jewish people. That's where the kedusha of the airspace came from. That's the ruchnius within them, and it was mekadesh the ruach within the Mishkan. And what he means to say, and says this in fact, is that means that even those who were unable to contribute before, so there is no material that is found in the Mishkan that we could say they gave. No. They were deprived from giving those materials. But their desire to contribute, it made a difference and made a contribution in the kedusha of the airspace of the Mishkan. And he cites, as a parallel to this idea, the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, which is taken to be a reference to the Mishkan, where it talks about all of the furniture, etc., Rafidaso, Zahav, Merkavo, Agaman, and then the pasuk says, Toho ratzuf ava. But the inside of this palace, what is it lined with? It's lined with love. And what that means is toho, the inside, what is it furnished with? Where does it come from? Where does its status come from? It comes from the love that was expressed by the Jewish people in their desire to give their donations, even if that was not realized in actuality, because Moshe had sent forth a message that the donation should stop. So on the one hand, we look at Parshas Vayakhel, and it's in the past, in the sense that we don't have a Mishkan anymore. But the concepts that we see that are expressed by the Parsha, what it means to be excited about a mitzvah, what it means to be involved in a mitzvah with enthusiasm, and what that says about a person cutting ties with other things that they were enthusiastic about that they shouldn't have been. And the result of every positive intention, every good thought, even something that a person is deprived from actually expressing, it may not be expressed on the outside. It makes a contribution on the inside. So these are some of the wonderful ideas that we have from Parshas Vayakhel. Even without getting too deep into the Parsha, we already see that these ideas expand. As Rav Huttner said, what begins in the Mishkan, it spills out. It spreads out into the world. It spreads out into life. When you leave Shul, when you leave the Mishkan, these are the certainly ideas well worthy of our reflection. And we will leave it over there for this evening. Wish you all a good week ahead. We should have Besuras Tovos, Leklal, Leprat. All the best.